This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother with people that I hate. That's why this chick is a tramp.
She doesn't like crack.
That's Tony Bennett. And the woman singing with him, Lady Gaga. Duets 2, which featured Bennett singing with the likes of Lady Gaga, Carrie Underwood, and Amy Winehouse, debuted at number 1 on the Billboard 200 chart. Tony Bennett was 85 years old, the oldest living artist to debut at number 1. Tony Bennett is an exceptional talent with old-school charm, but this sort of resurgence doesn't just happen. It was the result of 30 years of hard work from his son and manager, my guest today, Danny Bennett. Danny says, I don't just handle a career, I manage a legacy.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum.
And it was Danny who helped bring his dad's music to a younger generation. Danny got Tony on Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And it wasn't just the music. He put his dad on a budget. He stabilized his father's finances. Danny Bennett was a musician himself, but found he had a greater knack for business. Last year, he produced a film called The Zen of Bennett, which followed his dad throughout the recording of the duets album.
That cold, you know, your father built this building, you know that, don't you? Because every record went to number one. It actually made Capitol Records possible.
They do call it the house that Nat built. I love that. I think it's great.
Danny was used to hanging around these performers. He grew up surrounded by musical giants.
I was born in the Bronx, raised in Englewood, New Jersey.
Now you grew up in the Bronx till you were how old?
No, just like, you know, like 2
briefly,
years.
Briefly, yeah, quickly. Yeah. And then you guys went to Englewood.
Englewood, New Jersey.
Why?
Englewood was an amazing place. It's
Sure. It's
literally 15 minutes from Midtown, right across the George Washington Bridge. Mm-hmm. And I was born in 1954, 59 now. And it was a very exciting time. You had a lot of artists from kind of the showbiz thing. There was Tony, there was Dick Shawn, Joey Bishop, Buddy Hackett. They were just right there because they would just, Tony would come and do his sessions in the city at Columbia Studios, and then the jam session would continue in my house. So they would just like, hey, let's go back to the house. He had like a little studio when I say the basement, it was above ground basement kind of thing. You know, as a little kid, I'd wake up to the strains of like, you know, Count Basie and just amazing stuff.
So when you were a kid, I suppose most people would assume, are those your childhood memories of being awash in music of that period?
Well, you know, I often say now, like, I feel like Forrest Gump. I mean, I don't know why I had an appreciation for the moment. As a kid, I just did. It wasn't just music. Besides being able to sit on the piano stool with Duke Ellington, I mean, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. But I remember sitting on my dad's lap at a political rally with JFK running for president, you know, at the Teaneck Armory. He's sitting in back. There's Jack Kennedy giving a speech, and I'm seeing all the placards. You know, so it's like I'm always seeing the backside of things, mm-hmm. which is an interesting perspective because that it's just that image burned in my brain. What was I?
8 or 9 years old.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so it's those kind of things, or Louis Armstrong and Carol Channing at the White House. You know, it's like, what's that? Or
so people who sang standards and sang, whether they were Broadway tunes or they were standards by the Harold Arlens of the world and so mm-hmm. forth. But music for you, your personal music, was Dad going to the studio with Count Basie and you had an electric guitar in hand and you were singing Strawberry Fields?
Well, I mean, when I was 10 years old, the Beatles hit.
Sure.
And that was it for me.
Right.
And my brother, who plays drums, immediately I found an old guitar in my dad's closet and he's been trying to learn guitar for a long time. So I grabbed
He's going to get it eventually.
He's going to get it eventually, I'm telling you. But anyway, it was like a Goya nylon string guitar, and he had a book of 2,500 chords, one of those like things. And I just I was so obsessed. I had to meet the – or introducing the Beatles record. And I'd put the needle down and then, like go through the book and just, like, match the chord with the sound of the record. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a G chord. You know, it's like – and that's how I learned, you know, by ear how to play.
What was the name of your band?
Quacky Duck.
Right, right. And so Quacky Duck is you and your brother.
Yeah.
And you have Quacky Duck. And you were how old?
Well, we were like 16 at that point.
Okay, so you're teenagers. Yeah, yeah. Like old garage bands, you're teenagers.
Yeah.
And then, but at that same time, do you still have like this kind of bicameral relationship with music? There's your dad and his music, and that's a presence in your life, and you have a fondness for it?
Yeah, of course.
And an appreciation for it?
I mean.
And then you're playing your.
Yeah, I mean.
Because some people don't necessarily.
Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, Louis Armstrong. I mean, these are.
Royalty.
Royalty and huge influences on us. And then obviously. You know, we all have our icons. You know, Tony's has his icons, and rightfully so.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
But you're there, and what happens as you finish high school? Is there a time that you put down own musical career?
Yeah, yeah.
When was that?
Well, I mean, we were extremely serious about it. You know, when it was like we rehearsed on the week, you know, it was like after school. We did it. And then it's interesting because we were never kind of into sports, and that's what we did at a very early age. You know, we were doing like high school dances and really, I got to be honest with you, I haven't learned much since then. You know, we learned how to like, oh, wait a minute, you know what? We're selling tickets. You know, I remember going to, you know, the student union, you'd get paid $200, which was great in the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of money.
Sure.
So we kind of made it on our own. And the student union would go, $200. And I'm like, man, we're selling the tickets like to this show. So I would go to the student unions. I go, hey, look. I tell you what, you know what? You guys are always on the line. You don't know if you're going to make any money. No guarantee. We'll take a cut of the door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We'll take 80, you take 20.
And they're like, this is where?
This is at the high school.
At the high school. Oh my
and so
God.
They're going like, oh, you know, that's cool. Great. Yeah, we don't have to worry when we get our ass kicked. At the end of the night, I'm making $2,500. And they're going like, wait a minute, you know? Yeah. So then I just kind of like went from one school to another. And
you finished high school, and where'd you go?
We had to deal with Warner Brothers Records, and
who, you and
we used
your
to
brother.
Play Max's Kansas City, and you know, with Graham Parsons. I don't know if you know Graham.
Of course,
he was a good friend of ours. We toured with him, and you know, we were like those were our heroes at the time, and that's where I met Bonnie and John Prine, and you know, I had this kind of really extraordinary wealth because also his original tour manager was a guy named D. Anthony. He ended up being the penultimate like rock manager. And invented the triumvirate of promoter Bill Graham, D. Anthony, and the agent Frank Barcelona, and they brought all these artists in from England. And we spent—I was raised at Fillmore. We were kind of an art band. We played at Max's with the Modern Lovers and the New York Dolls, and we just said, let's come up with the most ridiculous name we can possibly come up with, because we thought the Beatles was kind of a ridiculous name, mm-hmm. right? So we were kind of making fun of that. So we were serious about that, working, built studios and did that kind of thing. And it just got to a point where, you know when you got it and you know when you don't. I was always so enamored by, especially the people I worked with and other writers in my band. I'd go like, I was kind of really good at like saying, wow, that's a great song. And I found that like that was my real talent. You know?
But that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then when does one day someone say, Danny, it's you. You're going to start becoming involved in this in Tony Inc.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Does it happen in a day? Is there an event that happens?
Well, kind of. And I can pinpoint when Tony kind of got on like, oh, wait a minute, he may know what's going on. The Beatles for me was, you know, I was obsessed not only the art of it, but the social aspect of it, the marketing of it. Marketing was fun. It wasn't a bad word. The balance between art and commerce, it was very much about what the Zen and Bennett is about. It's always been interesting to me. The Beatles always thought the 2 minute and 40 seconds that they had, that was their canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And how best to make that work. I love that concept. Mm-hmm. I love the constraints. Well, Tony always says there's free form. You got to learn form before you can be free.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to that. You know, they couldn't have done Hey Jude without doing all those great songs that, boom, there they are. Don't bore us, get to the chorus, but still maintain the art. So moving into a time when Tony was, we grew up around the, you know, it was just immersed. So, the dinner table, the conversations were about what was happening at Columbia Records. Oh, my God, Clive Davis, He was, you know, became president of Columbia, the first attorney. It was a freaky thing. I was very tuned into that, you know. Right.
But Sinatra didn't make either any of his daughters or his son the his right-hand man.
Well, that would have never happened.
Right.
We don't have to go there, but...
Right. But your dad did.
Yeah, well, he was at a point where the thing at Columbia, they tried to... You know, this happened to everyone. Sure. Sinatra, Barbra Streisand. You know, it was like, oh, you got to win
sing the Beatles catalog.
Beads and sing Barbra Streisand. They tried to get Barbra to sing Bob Dylan tunes. I mean, in 1969...
Yeah.
I mean, she's listening to Dylan going like,
blowing in the wind.
What's this? You know.
Blowing in the winds. The answer is blowing in the wind.
You know, brilliant idea.
Cut. That's a great one. Let's go again, Barbra.
So anyway, so Tony actually, you know, worked with Klein and he did an album that was kind of like that thing. And he got physically sick. He said he was like regurgitating between takes. And so, well, that's that great story that he tells about Clive Davis. Right,
right.
Where Duke Ellington went in and said, you know, he thought he was going in to get a raise. And Clive Davis said, well, I have some bad news for you. And he goes, what is it? And Clive's like, well, we're going to have to drop you from the label. Ellington goes, well, why? He says, well, you're not selling enough records. And Ellington goes, oh, I guess I was mistaken. I thought I was supposed to make the records and you were supposed to sell them. It's a great...
Yeah.
That's my edict.
Yeah.
Like, and I've heard that story when it happened.
That's every artist's anxiety.
But that was my thing.
Someone said to me, why do I hate making movies? And I said, do you really hate making movies? I said, well, maybe hate's a strong word, but I said, I'm very uncomfortable. They say, why? I say, because you just feel the hand of commerce at your throat every day we're shooting.
Every day.
It's never free. It's rarely fun. It can be challenging, but you just feel like every dime is being counted.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
So they wanted your dad to do what he couldn't do.
Yeah.
And he rebels against that. No, he doesn't want to do that.
He just kind of like, they gave him a big contract and he was like, no, I don't want to do this. I want to start my own label. Now, this is at a time when people weren't doing that. I mean, Sinatra did it with Mo Austin, but it was done more on a, you know, Warner Brothers thing. And he found Jack Rollins, Woody Allen's manager, mm-hmm. and, you know, a number of other people, great people, to work with him on a label called Improv. This is where he made the Bell Evans records, mm-hmm. you know, voice and piano. Those records weren't being made at the time. And so he came to me and talked to me about the label. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. I said, you know, it's risky. And he said, well, what's risky about it? And I said, well, it doesn't seem like they have major distribution. In this day and age, independent distribution is great. You can do it. Internet, blah, blah. But then it was a real challenge. I said, Columbia's offering you to do a distribution deal, which is a great, you know, which is great. It's kind of like, you know, they leave you alone. You can do what you want to do. He had me go talk to the guy who was running the company in Buffalo. He said, well, go talk to him. Now, you know, I got the long hair and a fringe jacket. And I go to this, you know, this guy, this hotel owner in Buffalo. And I'm sitting there and he's like, what the hell is this about? And I start talking about the distribution. I'm saying, yeah, it's great. Da-da-boom. And there were some other things about the contract that I didn't like that I told him about, you know, in terms of him kind of getting roped into it. And this guy just rejected that whole notion. So I went back to Tony and I just said, look, I wouldn't do this. I think there's, you know.
So no Improv records?
Well, no. He did it.
He did it.
And
how long did that last?
It lasted like 3 years, and they failed because of the distribution.
Right. So he does Improv records, and then because—
He can't get the records distributed.
Exactly.
And so that's what I told him. He remembered that.
Right.
And then the label folded, and then he was without a contract.
For how long?
Let's see, like— I would say 3 years.
Well, what
three,
was that like for him?
4 years. Well, it's tough because remember at the time, this is like around 78, okay? Sinatra retired.
Right. The Bee Gees are number one.
And Streisand's doing duets with the Bee Gees.
Yeah,
right? You know
Barry
what I'm saying?
Gibb.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So like there's that. He didn't want to do it. And then he was in Vegas. And in those days, you were doing Vegas, like, you know, the 32-week thing and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just called me up one day and he was just like, I don't, you know, I need some help here. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go.
He didn't have a manager.
He wanted to be able to do his art on his terms.
What was Vegas like for him? What is that like for someone? Because, I mean, you always figure... I remember reading Nick Tosh's book, Dino, about mm-hmm. Dean Martin,
yeah,
one of the best biographies I've ever read.
Yeah, yeah.
And they talked about how Martin, at one point in the 60s, I believe, was the highest paid entertainer in the world because he had the he touched every base. He touched all four bases. He had a television show. He had a recording contract. He starred in films. And he appeared live in Vegas in another concert. So he was making millions and millions of dollars back then. And I was wondering for someone like your dad, where I'm not going to say that I don't know what Vegas exemplified back then. Like for an actor, was that like being on a game show?
Or No.
So originally, there was prestige to it.
I mean, the idea that, you know, this is where they cut their teeth, the lounges. You know, Louis Prima in the lounge. You had Fred Astaire and Cary Grant going to see Sinatra and then going to the lounge, you know. And this is where the audience was like, yeah, you know. And Tony makes a good point. These people, we didn't have access to these people except the big screen. And all of a sudden, there they are sitting there watching Louis Prima, rubbing shoulders with Sinatra and Cary Grant and whatever. This was magic. And for Tony, you got to remember, Tony's 10 years younger than all these guys. These are his idols. Mm-hmm. You know, Sinatra called him the kid. Mm-hmm. You know? And there he is with them all. It's Fred Astaire. I mean, like
it was a salon.
It was a salon. So and nobody messed around for the very, you know, for the obvious reasons.
Right.
And then you got into kind of this evolution where, you know, the Summa Corporation and Howard Hughes took over. And like I had to negotiate with like Howard Hughes and these cowboys. It was really interesting.
What was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. You know, I mean, like, and this is where, like, Tony, when I first started working, and, like, you know, Howard Hughes is on the top of the Desert Inn. I mean, I know he's up there. And so there was, like, you know, this guy named Lenny, you know, and he'd go in with me to negotiate the contract. And Lenny'd get on his hands and knees. What the fuck? I'm going, seriously. And I'm going, what are you doing? And, like, get off your knees. I'm not going to get on my knees and beg for a contract. I'm just not going to do it, you know. And the guy.
What was he saying?
It's just saying,
get down on your knees. This is how it works here in Vegas. Get on our knees for Mr. Hughes.
Yeah, and he's got the guy's behind a desk with a big cowboy hat. And I'm like, oh my God. So I go to Tony, and here's a very interesting thing. I'm sitting outside the Desert Inn, just like, you know, and I'm in a bench. Some dude comes and sits next to me, an older guy, and he's grumbling. And I turn around and he's like, I'm never coming back to Vegas again. Right? He's doing that kind of thing. I'm like, what's up? I don't know. You know, they used to fly me out here and they said, man, they used to drop 50 grand a pop. But man, did they make me feel good about losing my money? The shows, the girls, like that. He's doing this. He goes, they take it all away now. They don't want to know me. He says, I'm never coming back again. And I had an epiphany. I was like, we got to get out of this town. Yeah, it's going down. Yeah. So I went to Tony and I said to him, here's the gig. You got to get out of this town. I know this is like, this is what
and
you're used
And go where?
To. And I said, you go to the people. We're going to go to colleges.
What year?
79.
This is the point in which you kind of climb into the cockpit with this guy who's this legend, and you're 25 years old. What you're teaching me in the conversation is that from the beginning, you were just saturated and inundated and interested naturally, not just in it on a creative level, but on a business level as well and on a technical level.
Growing up as, you know, in that environment where kids were befriending me because the parents knew that if they befriended me, maybe they could have dinner with Tony at the thing. I developed an early sense of like cutting through the crap. You know, it's like I knew who my friends were and who they weren't. Right. I could tell right away. So I had this epiphany and I said, you know what? I'm going to run him for president. I'm going to treat his campaign. I love history too, so I do love it. And I'm like, I'm going to do this like I'm running for president. And I went to him and I said, you know, presidents would not go to Iowa if they didn't have to go to Iowa and you know, shake the hands. I go, instead of having people come to you in Vegas, I said, your music transcends, right? And you can't do this with everybody. And I have an appreciation. You know, I watch Tony when, you know, how many times have I seen the show? He's reinventing himself. He's really kicking ass. I mean, in terms of like taking chances, that's really rock and roll. Mm-hmm. He's taking chances. You know, the Rolling Stones are getting older, not really taking chances anyway. And here's Tony, what he calls moving the furniture around.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, people just got to see this. There's a transcendent quality in great art that, like he says, defies demographics. So I got into that. So it's like Letterman was at, you know, doing the late show, you know, like where, you know, where Fallon is now. Mm-hmm. And nobody went on that show.
But after a few calls on Danny's part, Tony did.
Tony Bennett, Tony!
And there were other shows, many, many others.
Look, it's Tony Bennett!
Hey, good to see you.
It's the guest.
When did you first start charting? 50s?
In the 50s, yes.
The 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. You've been on the charts every decade.
Right.
Is there anybody else in history other than, like, Beethoven? Is there anybody?
Hey, Kermit, have you ever sung Firefly before?
Well, I can't say that I have, Tony, but, you know, I've certainly eaten a few. They're a good light snack.
Oh, boy. Hey, come on, let's do this.
Okay, you start it off, okay?
All right. Mm-hmm. I call her Firefly.
Firefly!
Cause oh my, she radiates moon glow.
In a minute, Danny Bennett talks about the challenge of keeping up with his 87-year-old father.
The guy doesn't like to take elevators. He doesn't like to take escalators. We go to airports, he's up the stairs.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This is Alec Baldwin. My guest, Danny Bennett, is president of RPM Records and has managed the career of RPM's biggest star, his father, Tony Bennett, for over 30 years. His dad's career has had its ups and downs. The 70s weren't kind to vocalists who weren't interested in recording contemporary material. In 1979, Tony Bennett had no contract, no manager, a drug problem, and the IRS was at the door.
Look, all artists go through this.
Oh.
When the Beatles hit, Sinatra and, I mean, everyone just, Elvis, he retired. He went
yeah,
away.
Yeah.
You know, they
you
were
eat peanut butter sandwiches.
A lot.
Yeah.
They were depressed. They were like, oh my God, the world's changing. You know, yeah, that there was a big part of that. And, you know, he moved to the West Coast.
He did.
Yeah. You know, and Tony.
What was that like for him?
It was hard. He's a New York boy.
Yeah.
You know, he's from Astoria, Queens. He loves going, you know, he walks.
Isn't it funny because the Beatles thing that matched you? When Lennon was down, he moved to L.A.
Yeah, exactly.
When Lennon was depressed, he moved to L.A.
And what happened? All right, so
it wasn't feeling so good.
It didn't do so well. Yeah. Well, the same thing kind of happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you know, got involved with the whole clique thing. Tony doesn't have a clique. He doesn't.
Yeah.
He doesn't relate to. He doesn't like entourages. He likes to keep it simple. You know, his apartment every year, like something else disappears. It's becoming more zen. You know, and he loves his view over Central Park, and he's got his paintings. That's what he does.
Right.
So the LA thing, and the parties, and it was hard.
Yeah.
Hard to keep.
And having to remind ourselves every 15 minutes who we are.
Exactly. And then, you know, you get into that thing where it's like, I'm missing out,
right.
You know, well, I should be at that party. And if I'm not, I'm a loser. You know, it's like, you know, the whole LA thing. So he's not that certain people are cut.
How long
out
did he
that.
Last out there?
Like 4 years, you know.
And he came back when, what year roughly?
76.
So that was the 70s.
Yeah.
So you say you book him on.
And he
on...
was like, you know, drug thing, financial thing.
Everybody.
Right.
Everybody.
So there was all that happening.
Yeah.
So I helped on, you know, it's funny because he wanted me to look at his finances. I'm not an accountant, but I'm a good common sense person. So we go to the accountant firm here and they, you know, they dump stuff out on a table. Like, and they're like, you know, like, yeah, let the kid figure this out.
Knock yourself out, kid.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to go have a coffee.
Exactly.
We'll be back in about an hour and a half.
We couldn't
What's your
do
name
any,
again? Danny?
We
yeah,
couldn't
good
do
luck,
any,
Danny.
We couldn't do anything. What do you think? You
yeah.
You know, it's like that.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
tell us when you got it all worked out, Danny. Call us.
Right. So anyway, we did.
And you did.
There were IRS problems. I went in and negotiated with.
But you, this is what's interesting about your family. A lot of people, some of the last people they trust are their own families. Some of the last, if I'm a guy.
I don't blame them.
Well, and a lot of these guys and women and people who make it big, and no one's made it bigger than your father, and they think everybody wants to just stick their straw in their drink and suck,
and
they want money. They're all in it for the wrong reason. You and he have, was it unique all along? Was sitting on your, and I don't mean to get too sappy and sentimental, but sitting on your dad's knee and it's JFK on stage and all that stuff, were you always close to him or were you a son? Like any son, and you got closer and closer, and he began to see more and more.
You know, it's interesting because we never related that way. So he kind of always related to me as an adult.
Danny, I want to talk to you. Son, I don't want you to be my son anymore. I want you to be my accountant.
He treated you like you were...
It was kind of like that.
Like you were a business associate.
No, he would...
a partner.
At the age of 12, he would come to me and he'd go like, I don't know, I got this thing and blah-da-da. What do you think? He didn't delineate. And you know what? I mean, you know, it's like, I guess, you know, at the turn of the century, kids at 12 and 13 were working the fields.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, yeah, they were doing operating machinery.
They were given responsibility.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that.
This was working in the fields for you.
This was working in the fields. You know, it wasn't like.
Go throw a baseball in the driveway.
Yeah. And you know, celebrity, we couldn't go to the zoo.
Right.
It was impossible. I mean, he took me to one movie, Planet of the Apes. I remember one movie. And that's okay.
Danny, we're never going to the movies together again. I'm sorry. I love you, son. But I'm going to build a theater out there in Englewood.
Exactly.
I'm going to watch the movies with Count Basie every Friday night.
And then that's that, you know. But I always dug the fact that, like, I got to go to the Copacabana, you know.
So the 80s go by, and you're in this phase where you're going to build RPM.
Yeah.
You're going to build your company. You're going to do what you want to do your way. But when did you know it was going to work? I don't mean to be corny and cinematic about it, but are you standing there one night in the wings and he's out there and you go, it's working?
No, I'll tell you when it was. Bob Guccione Jr. Was the editor of Spin Magazine, and I was reading it. They were interviewing him in his own magazine and asked him what he thought was the most influential thing about rock and roll, people in rock and roll. He said, two people, James Brown and Tony Bennett. And I was like, oh, that's wild, man. James Brown and Tony Bennett. And this is Spin Magazine, you know, it's like the Pixies and the. And then I went on to read, and the guy's like, well, why? Oh, you understand James Brown. Why Tony Bennett? He said, because he's always taking chances. It's like what I said. And this is what I was thinking about Tony. He's picking up this vibe on Tony. You know, it's like, I say Tony never sings the same thing once. He calls it moving the furniture around. He doesn't know, there's no such thing as complacency. And now we're watching our, you know, the big idols kind of get corporate, you know, with the Stones and doing that thing. And they're like cookies cutter. Mm-hmm. And Bob Guccione's talking about this being like, you know, the guy's an innovator. So I called him up. It led to kind of the, you know, they would do these fashion spreads. And I said, why don't we do something with the Chili Peppers and Tony and we could have fun with it. So we did a show at the Hard Rock Cafe in L.A. with the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Tony. The Chili Peppers were punk at that time, right? Before Rick Rubin got them. And I said that in a complimentary
just
way.
Just an observational way, in a musicological way.
They did a good job. From there, it was just kind of like, wait a minute.
Are you a snob because your father's a snob, or is your father a snob because you're a snob?
I'm not a snob.
We're going to come back to that. I'm not letting you off the hook. I'm not letting you off the hook there, buddy. he's with the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
No, so then I'm like, well, you know what? I was managing some other bands at that time in Boston. And then so like I kind of got into this notion like there were the alternative rock stations. And they did these college rock radio shows at like RFK stadiums with Nine Inch Nails and da-da-da. So I was like, gee, I wonder if like I pitched them, you know, about Tony being on the bill, if this would be novel enough for them. And I pitched it. We're down at Washington, D.C., RFK Stadium. And there's Tony. And we're RFK, 60,000 kids. It's P.J. Harvey. He's going on between P.J. Harvey and Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor. Oh
my God. And what happened?
Well, Tony's standing here looking, and he goes, can I ask you something? And he goes, would Frank do this? And I said, nope. And that's why you're doing it. And he goes, okay, I get it. And he goes out, kills, man.
God.
Kills. God. I mean, and we were all, you got to take chances, you know, like we don't take chances anymore. And he kills.
If it's good, they're going to dig it.
They're going to dig it, and they wouldn't let him off the stage. Just this trio. Look, I consider myself a dragon slayer for Tony. He calls me up once a month, I swear to God. Says, you know what? I just want to thank you once again that I never have to talk to another record executive in my entire life. I helped him unblocked the artistic channel. So I consider myself a dragon slayer as far as that's concerned. And I think that's what I'm proudest of as far as that's concerned, you know.
So you go through this period. The 80s and the 90s, and
then
so
we
forth.
Did the MTV. But then, like because those concerts, I said, "Screw this! I'm doing LA K Rock. So I did like five of these things. Then he comes into me one day and he goes, You know, and now I'll do Tony. You know, I was watching MTV. I think I can do really well on TV, and then just walks out of my office. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I'll get on that. Let me make a call.
Well, you know, and then
hello,
I'm
MTV.
Like, no, but that's Tony, man.
Yeah, no.
You know,
and I'm like, why not?
I got it. Well, Tony spelled backwards is what? Why not? That's what I say. Anyway, so then it was kind of like, well, how am I going to do this? You know, Jon Stewart had a new show. They didn't really have artists. I said, well, I'll put Tony on the Jon Stewart show. And I kind of sold that idea. And Doug Herzog, who now is a Comedy Central at the time, and it was like, that could be interesting. And then, this is around 88 now. They dug it. So they put him on. Then it was like, then I'm kind of.
How did he feel?
He's cool.
Here's your father who, like any artist with a career that lasts decades, technological advance and change becomes another mountain for him to climb. Now he's on a television music channel. Did he love it?
No,
did he dig it?
Here's the thing. It's the audience. His audiences were getting older. And when we were in front of that young audience, it's up here. Mm-hmm. And then he became 20 years old, I swear to God. Mm-hmm. I watched him. You know, he just rises to the occasion from that audience. He doesn't like to do arenas and things. He feeds off of that. And here's the deal. So it was like they came and it was like, you know, we got Unplugged. That'd be interesting to do Unplugged. So I was like, yeah, fantastic. So seriously, man. Got all the MTV people, all the record people, and they start going, great, you know, we got this is going to be fantastic. Tony's going to sing Within and Without You. A Bono song and like Runaway Train. And I was like, whoa. I said, you know what, guys, I really appreciate this, but this is a train wreck. Never going to happen. And I walked out. And then they said, well, come back in. What are you talking about? I said, listen, you guys are MTV. This was in the day of MTV. I said, you guys got balls. There's no balls to do. What's going to take balls is to do Tony's music and have them sing Tony's music. And I said, that's balls. That's MTV. And they were like, yeah.
Yeah, you know? We got balls.
We got balls.
Don't we?
We're going to do that.
Don't we, Mary? You have balls, don't you, Mary?
Yes, I do. I've got huge balls.
Yeah.
Whose idea was the duets album originally?
I mean, you know, it wasn't an original idea.
No, but I'm saying, but for
I thought that
those are very complicated things to do.
The point
to lasso all those people, isn't that a pain in the ass?
Yeah. You know, you had Sinatra and then you had Ray Charles. I mean, he sold 15 million records. Mm-hmm. Pretty good idea. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm like, you know, how do I go and reinvent Tony? You know, we went on with MTV to win Album of the Year with the Grammys, got a lot of people upset. You know, it was like, what's going on with that? But when you look at it, you know, Alec, it's like he heralded in the iPod generation. You can listen to Tony and Billie Holiday and also listen to Pearl Jam. And, you know, it didn't matter. So kids started opening up to that. He's, you know, I give him a lot of credit for that.
Now, your father has you in his corner, obviously, for many, many years now. His own son is flesh and blood. He has a wife. Your stepmother, who
Susan.
Is obviously is omnipresent and around all the time
yep.
and with him. He's got two people who are taking good care of him, and he's getting on in years. I mean,
my brother's been producing his records.
Brothers. And I'm assuming that a lot of it is you got to take as much stress off him as possible because he's working a full schedule.
Yeah, well.
And he's 80, what, years old
He's going to be 87.
And he's still going.
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't look at me and go like, what are you doing? You know, leave him be.
No, no.
And then they
do.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, it's not me.
Right.
I mean, seriously, I'm very, you know, conscientious of his age. The guy doesn't like to take elevators. He doesn't like to take escalators. We go to airports. He's up the stairs. He's the first one. I mean, keeping up with him is a challenge.
There's something about people who... they make the most of what they have. I mean, there are people who they have something. Pacino once had a great line to me. I said to Pacino, you ever get uptight when you make films with people who you worry about they might not be able to cut it? Like, you don't want to exert too many controls and authorities and approvals and that this guy in the cast drops out and this girl shows up, this guy shows up. You're doing scenes with people and you're Al Pacino and these other people maybe aren't as good as you. What do you do? And I'll never forget Pacino says, Alec, he says that what I realize is everybody's talented in this business. Everybody who makes it to the level we're at, making films and everything. He said,
they're all talented. He said, some are just more talented than others. But everybody, I say to myself, everybody's talented. And I go, he said, like, someone would say, he had a talent for telling jokes. Or he had a talent for dealing cards. Everyone's talented at something. So the thing to me is that there's people in this business who they go far and they make the most of what they have. And what they have is like, blah, blah, blah. But your father was somebody who had the most.
Yeah.
He had the most talent. Your father, I'll sit down.
You know, I don't know if it's the most talent. I think he's tuned into his talent the most.
Well, that's your opinion. You know, he owes you a lot.
Yeah.
He owes you a lot. Yeah. No, but I'm saying you've helped him to keep that fire burning, because there's a lot of people who, what happens is they have the talent. What they lose is the will. They're like, I just don't want to do this anymore.
I know. I've sat with them. They lower the bar because they don't want to be disappointed. I mean, that's the key. Tony never lowers that bar.
Right, never.
It's always up.
Why
and
do you
that's
think
cool.
that is? What is it in him?
Look, I was watching, once again, I hadn't seen in a long time, the Maisels Brothers film on Horowitz. You know that one?
No, I never saw it.
Oh, my God. You got to watch
it. Oh, you will.
They're just filming him playing piano in his living room. And you watch this guy playing, you go like, where is that coming from, right? Yeah. He's somewhere else.
Yeah.
And Tony's like the same way. That's why I had Lost in the Stars at the end of the movie, Zena Bennett. Lost in the Stars, you know. He's out, it's out there in the cosmos. And I don't want to, you know, it's the essence of Zen. It's about being in the moment. It's about, for me, it's about the you know, art is like, you know, James Joyce says about, it's an arresting moment. And the world disappears. And you're in the moment. But when you do that, it puts us in the moment.
And we're lost out here in the stars.
Find out more about Danny Bennett's film, The Zen of Bennett, on our website, heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio.